You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to another fabulous episode of Dear Multi-Hyphenate. I'm your host, Michael Kushner, and I'm so excited to bring this 51st episode to you. As always, please download and subscribe and rate wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps. And please follow me on social media at the Michael Kushner or at Dear Multi-Hyphenate. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can also email me at dearmultihyphenate@gmail.com. Little update on the book, How to Be a Multi-Hyphenate in the Theater Business, Conversations, Advice, and Tips from Dear Multi-Hyphenate. It's chugging along, and writing a book is very hard, but I think I'm going to be able to bring you a really cool cohesive journey of how to be a multi-hyphenate in the theater business in the 21st century. Lots of things that we've talked about in the podcast, but also lots of things that we haven't yet covered in the podcast. So that's going to be coming your way in 2022, spring of 2022, and I'm really excited to share more information with that. But anyway, let's move on with this next episode. I have Roger Q. Mason, who is an award-winning writer, performer, and educator known for using history's lens to highlight the biases that separate rather than unite us. Mason's playwriting has been seen all over New York in various locations like Broadway Circle and Square, and the New York Theater Workshop, New Group, Dixon Place, the Flea Theater, Access Theater. So many wonderful spaces have been able to share Mason's incredible insight. And this episode, I'm going to be very honest with you, it's one of my favorites. Roger is so hysterical and so spiritual and wonderful and just amazing. And I really feel like I not only made a lifelong friend, but I feel like we've been friends for forever. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. Again, rate, comment, subscribe, and thank you to Broadway Podcast Network for giving me this opportunity to speak to all of you. Thank you to Alan, my producer, Dory, Britt, Katie, Yo, and Patrick, who engineered this episode. And as always, we start with a quote. But this time, it's not like a quote that's like, oh, said by, you know, Krista McAuliffe, or I don't know why Krista McAuliffe was the first person to come to my mind, but or like Teddy Roosevelt or Rosa Parks. It's not. This quote is more of an excerpt from my guest's website, and it's their philosophy on telling stories. And on their website, it says, "I love telling stories, and the most immediately fulfilling way I do so is through live performance. There's nothing in this world like the rush of bearing yourself before a room of people. You learn what you're made of as a storyteller. There's no return button, no time to edit, just you, the people, and opportunity." I'm so excited to welcome Roger Q. Mason. How are you?
Honey, I don't even remember when I said that, but I suppose I did.
You probably didn't even say it. It was just your website person, and they were like, "Yeah, well, this sounds like Roger. It's fine."
I mean, it feels. If I didn't say it, which I'm sure I did at some point, it certainly does feel like me, because, to me, there really is nothing like live performance. And live performance is really what reinvigorated my work as a writer. If I were to name the single most important thing that happened over the last 5 years to me, it was that I ordered a pair of heels in size 15 from some drag queen's website. And I got on the stage in Soho and played Molasses Jones in a reading of my play, The Pride of Lions. And doing that really changed my relationship to writing. And it never has been the same. And thank goodness for it.
Isn't that incredible? You know, we all have an inciting incident. Speaking of writing, right? We all have this inciting incident that spurs a moment in our artistic identity in our lives. And I love how personal these inciting moments can be. You know, this, you know, you buying the heels and playing Molasses Jones, and mine was, you know, my grandma teaching me stage right from stage left in front of the Mary Poppins VHS, you know, when I was 3 years old.
Wow.
And we all have these incredibly personal inciting incidents. And, you know, I think as multi-hyphenates, we are performers and writers and all of these incredible, wonderful proficiencies. I think that we have to pay attention to those inciting incidents, because that's when it sort of keys us in to the moments where we have to sort of go, what's next?
Right. Right.
When do you feel like you really paid attention to those moments? Like, because that's what we have to do, right? As artists, we have to constantly reflect and wonder where we fit in the world. And I'm just wondering, like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I mean, I have to take you all the way back to, I would say middle school or
elementary school.
You know, what has happened to me in the last year is that I wrote an elegant apology note and amplification to my 12-year-old self. And I told her, she, they, them, not he, not the gender that was assigned, because that individual already was living in the they, them generation. That individual already knew my 12-year-old self. And I remember when I was in middle school, I would audition for these musicals. They had these sort of like, you know, Broadway junior musicals, but it was a different company at the time. I don't remember which one. And I would go and I would audition, and I would feel the most free and unabashed that I'd ever felt in my life. I mean, talk about a Billy Elliot moment, honey. Mm-hmm. She was free. That was a free bird. And that was taken away by respectability, by queer shaming, by familial gender policing over the next 6 to 8 years through high school, through college. And I had to spend the next 10 years reclaiming a relationship to that 12-year-old self, because all I ever wanted to do was sing the blues. There I was, 12 years old, you know. And I remember I would sing, won't you come along with me to the Mississippi? We'll take a boat. Oh, I'm not going to sing it. My voice is gone today. But I mean, that's all I ever wanted to do was sing the blues, you know, and I felt most unabashed as that person. So then we come into writing, and writing in the beginning was a separate act from performance and theatrical life. Because at that time, I was interested still in being a man of letters. So I still had a very two-dimensional literary relationship to writing. I hadn't quite understood that writing was a blueprint, at least for theater. I hadn't understood writing as a blueprint for a performance event. I didn't understand that yet. And so I was still writing from a literary place. And I was writing to be approved and applauded for my linguistic intelligence, because I wanted, you know, I wanted daddy and mommy to say good job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, honey, she had to wig the fuck out, literally. And when I did, then the writing became less about begging for acceptance and respectability, and it became more about telling the damn truth. And doing it through an embodied way that only a performer understands, how you bear your soul and bear witness to opportunity. And that's when everything changed, you know? I mean, so I've always been a multi-hyphenate, and I was socialized into ignoring that self for a long time. And it was when I came back and put all of those parts together that I found the freedom of expression and the innovation to become the writer I am today. And I swear when I get back to New York, I'm gonna go to Juilliard and beguile some vocal coach to put whatever vocal cord and larynx is left back together. But I'll leave the heavy lifting to you all Broadway titans. You all are the masters and mistresses and mavens of magic on the key.
It's so, I think that there is such a wonderful, wonderful comparison to gender and the multi-hyphenate.
Yeah.
Because the multi-hyphenate is an artist that is experiencing a non-binary of art.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I want to do this. I want to be able to do that. And I think that there are certain guidelines to protect not only that person's artistry, but also like the recipients are like, say if there's an audition going out, right? Mm-hmm. And or a job opportunity, if there's a regional theater and they're looking for a stage manager,
right?
A person that has dabbled or has stage managed a friend's improv show for just for a song, would they apply for that job? Would they be considered for that job? And they have to have that conversation with themselves and understand if that skill can evolve into a proficiency, and then they can hold down the cord of a regional theater. It's up to them. But regardless, we have, you know, actor, photographer, producer, we have all of these things where it's not just black and white. It's not just boy, girl. And it's the same with gender, where we're getting society to go, it's not just what you know. It's actually this as well.
Right. Well, here's the thing you have to think about. Along the road to commercialization, we lost a really key link in the chain of art making, which is that it is interdisciplinary by nature. In fact, the very definition of art, as I remember it being taught to me when I was learning oil painting, comes from an Arabic word, which means putting fine things together. So it's collage-like, it's interdisciplinary in nature and in etymological fact. The word itself used to describe this activity, which we perform, is an act of putting things together. And when you start having to commodify something or departmentalize something in order to put it in a box so that it can be charged for at this rate or that union rate or this or that, the fluidity of the thing gets eroded along the way. Now, there is such a thing as auteurism as well. Somebody who sees, and I want to demystify and undemonize that word, because we look at the egoistic underpinnings of that word. Oh, somebody who's a control freak or whatever. But I think I want to return to the understanding of an auteur as somebody who sees and processes narrative information in an interdisciplinary and holistic way, such that they conceive of an event. And when they conceive of an event, they are aware in the mechanisms that they are using to tell it of how different facilities, whether it's lighting, sound, direction, producing, how these all work together holistically. When I was growing up, I had many heroes. Two of them were Emily Mann and George C. Wolfe. And the reason is because they were storytellers that were able to waft between job descriptions because they understood theater making as one harmonious whole. Mm-hmm. It was one spiritual and civic event manifested by departments, but conceived of as one expression. And they possessed in their storytelling genius minds the ability to put those fine things together. And at times they directed, or at times they wrote, or at times they did both, or at times they, you know, were producing a piece. But the mentality of seeing the whole thing, that is something that I can never turn off. If I'm directing a project, you know I'm going to be sitting there having an entire dramaturgical debate in my head.
Of course.
If I'm writing a piece, I'm going to be thinking about how are we manifesting this in three dimensions and what are the facilities that I can use in order to achieve that psycho-civic effect on the human mind and the social body that's watching it. Because it's all sleight of hand and a little bit of mind trickery, this whole thing. You know very well what happens when you sing a song in E flat major. Everybody starts crying.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it has a particular psychological effect and it's intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And a writer that thinks holistically and understands holistically knows, okay, now we're going into the nostalgia beat. Boom, where's that E flat? Boom, call Judy, get her on the phone. You know, but Michael, that's the gift and the blessing, I think, of starting out. You see, I believe in taking Meyer lemons and turning them into Meyer lemon marmalade. Hello? Not who just needs lemonade, honey.
Marmalade.
Marmalade, which we can then put some seltzer water in and also have lemonade too.
Serve it on the Titanic and call me for dinner because that sounds fabulous.
That's right. Because here's what happened along the way of being told no. I found it as an opportunity to find yes.
Of course.
You know, I mean, that's the queer way of being in the world, I think, is we're constantly having to take our oppression and use it as a drum major for our ultimate justice and deliverance. So because I had to not perform, but I never lost my performerly self, and I started exploring directing, producing, writing, I developed a multi-hyphenate mindset about storytelling. Mm-hmm. I took no and turned it into yes, and I actually think I'm better for it.
Now, I think we all are.
You know. Now, I'm sure if I had honed the skills, and I'd have been a fine, you know, torch song singer for a time, but I'm grateful for the person I became and am becoming still, you know. But I think you're right. We multi-hyphenates are better for it because there is longevity in multiplicity of understanding.
It is the one, I think multi-hyphenating and what I'm understanding in my studies and writing this book is that multi-hyphenating might be the one way that artists can subject themselves to an almost mathematical equation of hashtag quote unquote success in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it does is when one structural pillar of your hyphen identity is in disarray or is having an identity crisis or it's willing to take on the next shape, you can always call upon the next one.
You're always hustling. And also, always. And because you're multi-hyphenate, you know and have mastered the fine art of the pivot.
Please.
You know, yes. I mean, we just live in the pivot. And because of that, because we're flexible and pliable, you know, vocationally, we're able to slip and slide, move in and move out and be successful in various arenas. So we've done what Oprah always told us on her show. We have diversified our portfolio.
Yes, we have. Speaking of multi-hyphenates, are you kidding me?
Hello.
And that's and I've said this in previous episodes, but I think multi-hyphenates are made primarily of women of color and the LGBTQIA plus community because our stories are not centered. And in order for us to tell our stories, we are the ones that are responsible for putting them on our shoulders and raising them above the crowds and selling our wares in that respect. And
on the corner.
On the corner. And we have to figure out how to tell that story, and we got to figure out how to get it in front of the people with the money, and we have to figure out how to get it into a mainstream or commercial or not commercial, like whatever it is, whatever the goal is, how to get it in a situation like that. And so I think by nature, what you were saying earlier is that I think the multi-hyphenate is, it is a chemical biological experience, because the need to get a story across, once we find the need to get a story across, and once we find our why and our points of view, it doesn't matter the medium in which we tell the story. It just matters that we tell the story.
Well, here's what it is. We're natural born entrepreneurs. We're natural born entrepreneurs by force. We have to be, because we don't fit in anybody else's boxes, and we don't, and we don't get invited through the front door. So we either have to find innovative ways of coming through the side or the back door or underground, or we have to create a door of our own. Mm-hmm. And all the while, we're both working on our businesses and in our businesses, and simultaneously having to live authentically in ourselves, but also abstract ourselves to be accessible to other people, such that we are both painstakingly specific and authentic, whatever that means for people, but also seeking some sort of universality. And the space that it takes mentally to create that kind of business and sustain that kind of relationship to your art is, I think, the mental gymnastics of a very high functioning, chemically blessed, but neurochemically blessed individual. Now, whether that's nature or nurture, you would have to bring a psychiatrist on here, you know, to explain how neuron and synapse works in the sight of trauma, starvation, mm-hmm. and denial. Mm-hmm. What survival methods do people who are on the outside of the glass house develop biochemically in order to survive and last? That's the ultimate question. But I am no scientist, but I guarantee you some scientists would come on here and say, that crazy bitch wasn't that far off. And would give you some, you know, Columbia Presbyterian approved statement of blah, 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 H154, and we don't know what the hell you just said. In layman speak, honey, you had to develop some extra neurons and some electricity in your brain in order to survive, period. Boom.
Boop. Multi-hyphenates are also a sign of fight or flight.
That's right.
We fight. We don't, if someone tells us no, we don't run away. We fight it. We go, all right. Even if we don't fight them directly.
Right.
We fight the blockage of the denial. We go, all right. Thanks so much, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry. Like, you won't give me the $10,000. I'm going to go find it somewhere else. Okay.
That's right. And the Capricorn in me, see, now I'm going to add this, because not only do I have the multi-hyphenate thing, now I'm astrologically prone to fight. Yes. And the Capricorn in me relishes the process of creating systems to turn no into yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, it is the systematizing of turning fortune around, of mitigating vicissitude.
Come on, vicissitude. I went to high school with her.
Listen. We on the Broadway network. I'm gonna throw around some $300 words, because we here for it. This is the place for it. Hello, babies. Mother is here. You know. But how do you turn no into yes? Well, you do it systematically. And somebody like me, you know, whether you believe in astrology or chalk it all up to personality type, if you want to be so westernly inclined or, you know, secular, whatever it is, the fact of the matter is my personality type or astrological type, it enjoys the mental machinations of system building. I like it more than the result, honestly. You know, that's why I like rehearsal and tech on a show. Yes. I'm happy when a show opens, and I'm happy if it's a smash and it's getting great reviews, and that's all wonderful. But what brings me joy is the process of getting there. What intelligence was tested, what skill sets were were really exercised, sometimes surprisingly or unwittingly. What new elements of craft or survival skill did I discover through this process that I will now take with me that will equip me for the journeys to come? That is exciting. There's nothing more exciting than the discovery of your own skill set. I love that. Finding out what you're made of. That's the beauty of life.
That is the beauty of life. And that, and you say it so, so beautifully yourself. And there is certainly a science to multi-hyphenating. There is a biological, chemical experience that is multi-hyphenating. And whether or not, like what you said, is it nature or nurture, is we got to bring on someone to figure that out. But when it's applied, and I think multi-hyphenating is a really interesting magnet of itself, because there's the ends sort of retract from each other, like,
right?
Because on paper it looks like a very self-focused experience. Like, it looks like it's very me. I'm going to take the story and I'm going to star in it and direct it and take all these jobs from everyone else. But really, when it's rooted in service, when it's rooted, and the multi-hyphenate is usually, it has to be rooted in service.
Yes. It has to be rooted. I'm here. I'm going to do this too. We have to remember the Africanist roots of Western drama. We have to remember that the first noted and Greek acknowledged ritual of theater was the festival of Isis and Osiris, in which Upper and Lower Egypt were united in body and spirit so that winter could become spring and the harvest would prevail. We have to remember that the reenactment of the rememberment of Osiris's dismembered body, that act was a civic, public, and communal event that through performance brought unity to the people. We as multi-hyphenates were, and I think still are, spiritual leaders. We have a responsibility to the people and their connection to the stars. We tell the stories and write the tales of days gone by that remind people who they are, where they've been, and where they're going. We cast the spells that enchant nature to let the sun rise and the moon fall and the rain descend upon us and the crops to grow. That's the power we have. If we harness it and acknowledge it with humility and grace and community engagement. And so anytime I get the opportunity to write a play or work in community with people on a project of mine, I know that it is a holy act. Mm-hmm. I know that it is a blessing, first of all, because opportunity is so rare in the world.
Opportunity is not a lengthy visitor.
It is not a lengthy. Come on, Dr. Sondheim.
Come on, Dr. Zizmore.
Hello. But more importantly than that, to whom much is given, much is expected in return. You know, there are people coming up after us who are looking at us in these moments of opportunity, and they are using us as possibility models for the roads they will travel. And so I believe we have to be doubly aware of the road that we're on and aware of the road that we're on that other people are watching, looking to it as an example and a font of hope.
It's so beautiful that you're saying this, because I think in the corporate aspects of theater and the commercial aspects of theater, the joy is often taken out of it, because we're constantly, like I said before, we're selling our wares.
Yeah.
You know, we're constantly, you know, like what you said, we're on the corner selling, making it get seen. Mm-hmm. So in the creation of things, it's so nice to hear you talk about the stars and about the crops growing and about the spiritual divinity that is art, that is the art that we get to participate in.
That's right.
But then on top of that, the power and the control that we get to harness over what we produce.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get to just put it out there and hope that a man with a lot of money is gonna rescue us and produce it in his theater. We get to make those decisions.
I have to tell you, I work with one of the great producing minds alive today, Adam Hindman.
I love Adam. Was a guest on this podcast.
That is my brother from another mother. We are two Black and Filipinx theater makers doing the good work from here to Jesus and back. And I have to tell you what he believes about the role of the producer and how to engage with investors is revolutionary, because he says, we're not approaching investors for money. We're approaching investors to participate in the distillation of an ideal that is manifested through a play. He's saying, change the mindset of the investor. Don't tell them that they're going to get X, Y, and Z dollars back. Tell them that they're investing in something larger than themselves. And that the dividends are both monetary, but also eleemosynary. Mm-hmm. And by changing the philosophy and the communication method and the mindset of not only the producer, but also the investor, you create a different culture around the occasion of producing work commercially. It does become, in effect, political, because people are investing in the propagation of an idea. They are giving to a cause, not giving to, this ain't Merrill Lynch. This
not
ain't
Ernst & Young.
You know, I listen, I'm not knocking folks who are in the business of making money through art. I'm not. We've all got bills to pay, honey. And that insurance fee every month, that premium is not going down. Okay. So I am not knocking it. I respect it. I understand. I could use some coins too. But what I am suggesting is that I think we have to view our role in the art making endeavor as something larger than ourselves. At least sometimes, to ground us, because otherwise, as you're suggesting, we get lost along the way and the joy leaves. Mm-hmm. The joy leaves when you don't. So as long as I'm making art in this business, and however high I may be blessed to climb on this little ladder of ours, I will always be grounded in knowing that I'm responsible to the stars first. That I came of stardust, and that it sprinkled upon me a few dust mites of opportunity. That I was given a little bit of sight and insight into how to use language to sway this human spirit. And that's a gift. And I have a divine obligation to manifest work using that skill set with joy for the benefit of other people. Child, I said dust mites of opportunity. Lord help us, Jesus. I was...
you know,
stardust, anything. I couldn't think of it.
when Dear Multi-Hyphenate is going to start having merch, I'm going to make little dust mites of opportunity.
Dust mites of opportunity.
Everyone can buy one.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I find that just, I find that there's a part of me that my initial reaction goes, yeah, but, you know, a Penn State grad, money, you know, wants to, business person, wants to be a billionaire. You know, they don't think like us. They don't think like us. They don't engage in the possibility, and they don't engage in the ethereal, and they don't engage in the heart. But then at the same time, they do. And I don't know if it's just been awakened yet. And I think it is part of our responsibility. It's I think what happens is, as artists, we go, what does our product inspire? What does our product inspire? Like, what do we want? What do we want the audience to do when they see our play, when they see us on stage, when they hear our song, when they whatever? But really, the way that we inspire and affect is in every effort of ourself. And that's what's really important about the multi-hyphenate, is that from the beginning, when we are working with investors to make that to get those four 25K units, if we're raising $100,000 as a co-producer, what we are doing is inciting change.
Right.
And I think that that is a really, really interesting way, because people do want to change. People do want to say that they were a part of a momentous experience.
Absolutely.
And I find that to be, I think if we look at it that way, I think we might be able to move mountains a little quicker.
And I think you would identify funders that don't traditionally get tapped for projects because it's a different cultural model. You know, you phrase and ask one way, and you reach a certain types of demographics. You phrase and ask a different way, and all of a sudden you open the market up to other people. You know, another thing that's interesting when we talk about diversity is also diversity of funding. Who has the ability to contribute to the future of an artistic work? Who do we make that opportunity available to? How do we open those doors and make that aspect of culture accessible to people that are not quite ready to invest because they don't see themselves or their lived experience in the ask? You know, I'm not even saying lived experience in the play, lived experience in the way that asking for money is presented. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that bank, you remember Ally Bank, and it presented itself or purported itself to be a sort of the bank of the people. Well, it's probably gone now, but it was supposedly a bank that didn't have all the fees, that was online, and that was more egalitarian in its interfacing. You know, what I'm saying is that I feel as though when we talk about how do you motivate people to give to a project, well, you somehow discuss with them how that project is relevant to their lives and their lived experience, but also how bringing that project to the general public is contributing to some larger ethos that they feel a part of or want to be a part of. You open it up and you show the ways in which doing this project reflects their ideals, larger than just the money exchange. And that's what I really think is quite beautiful and quite interesting about Adam's theories on producing. It really opens up a completely different and broader perspective on the occasion for funding a work. It proves that the work is indeed larger than itself, not only thematically and ideologically, but also humanistically, because it's inviting people from different creeds and points of view who all want to see this idea explored and are willing to invest in the propagation of that idea. It makes the exchange less binary and more fluid and actually more multi-hyphenate.
It blends the efforts of commercial theater and artistic
choices. Yeah, because some people may be drawn to the political aspects of a piece. Mm-hmm. Some people may be drawn to the artistic aspects of a piece. Some people may be drawn to the, to the sort of social aspects. And it just opens it up and says, we've got something for everybody here and we're willing to meet you where you are. And we've got, you know.
I'm looking at it like it's a music, like it's a piece of art at an auction, right? And how theater is the same in regards to raising money, right? Like you could buy the art piece right here. It's $25,000, except it's not going to be in your own home. It'll be at the Richard Rodgers Theater. It'll be at the Majestic Theater. But this is yours and you will help. It's not only the finished product, but you will also help cultivate it and get it to where it is. Right. There is this, it makes the commercial aspect of theater artistic.
Well, it takes the individual ego out of it. Mm-hmm. It takes the individual need for self-affirmation and acknowledgement, and it turns it around and says, yes, you will be acknowledged and you will be contributing to something larger than yourself. We never want the investor to not feel that they individually are appreciated. We love them. Mm-hmm. We just want to say, remember that we are all working collectively towards a much larger goal.
You're amazing, Roger. I'm obsessed with you.
Oh, Lord.
So the reason why you're on your multi-hyphenate is to not only just have an incredibly wonderful conversation about the multi-hyphenate perspective, but let's talk about why you're here, even though we could talk about all things multi-hyphenating forever, but let's talk about the New Visions Fellowship. The New Visions Fellowship is an innovative and rigorous year-long professional development program created by National Queer Theater and the Dramatists Guild to support emerging Black, trans, and gender nonconforming playwrights. And you are one of the founders and creators, and you will also serve as the 2021 Fellows Mentor. So tell me about it.
Yes, about a year ago, Adam Odsess Rubin brought me into a series of conversations with the Dramatists Guild and also the Dramatists Foundation to imagine how trans and gender nonconforming playwrights could be mentored in our changing and many times erasing business. We were very concerned at that time in how to develop the aesthetics and the professional awareness of young trans, gender nonconforming Black playwrights, because they were and still are one of the endangered populations within the American theater, rarely seen, often overlooked, and never truly understood. And my perspective on that was, well, we have a completely different way of telling story. And I gave an anecdote of a theater that gave me quite an insulting rejection of a play because there was too much white space on the page. And the individual was so neurotically concerned with my ability to fulfill a certain time budget. They were worried about the play being long enough to be read or presented in a particular time frame. And they were concerned and suspicious of my use of white space as not fulfilling that time. I said, okay, now let me break this down. You are reading a play, and see, I'm gonna do this, and we hear on this show, so I'm gonna do this one.
Do it.
I believe that publishing culture of plays, starting with Ben Jonson, created a literary relationship to an ephemeral capturing. So we read plays from a two-dimensional literary point of view. Now there's a truly brilliant artistic director, BJ Evans, over at Brick Lab, who trains their readers to analyze a script for its potentiality, not just what they're seeing on the page, but how is this a blueprint for a three-dimensional event? The potentiality. Now, at the time I had received this phone call, I was also falling madly in love artistically with a playwright named A. Boylan, who had a piece called Virgo that was sort of a genderqueer coming-of-age piece. And at the beginning, in their frontispiece, or just after the frontispiece, they give an instruction to say, I'm going to be having a lot of white space, and this should not be read as an indication of performance time, because we do a lot of performance and duration exercise and expressionistic work that takes more time than we can provide the ocular proof for, as Shakespeare would call it, on the page. In other words, this woman that was commenting on my white space on the page was reading the play from a dialogue-based cause and effect, cisgender, male-guided realism perspective, and saying, well, there's, you know, it's about a minute or two per page, 2 minutes for monologue. I know what the hell this person was doing. Well, honey, we have a different time and a different rhythm and a different relationship. Sometimes I'm going to sit on stage and I'm going to spend 5 minutes just feeling myself. Because sometimes the scene just needs to say, she bathes in the moonlight of the morning after. The moonlight of the morning after. Now you figure that one out. Go call the top-notch designers in town and have them interpret that. And it's a feeling. And so I said, well, we need to identify and then cultivate the impulses of writers like myself and A. Boylan, who develop work on the page that does not, that's queer, that has a queer and queering relationship to dramaturgy. And we have to now educate the readership of this country on how to absorb these plays, not just as two-dimensional literary expressions, but for their potentiality as performance events. Because as queer folks who live outside of the binary, we are developing work that not only questions, but also dismantles and disrupts the boxes in which our stories were erased. Y'all didn't want me in your kitchen sink. I was the butt of the joke in the 90s on your sitcom. Mm-hmm. I was Coco, who didn't make it past episode one of Golden Girls. Mm-hmm. So now how do I make a world of my own? Well, it doesn't look or sound or feel or receive expression in the same way that yours does. I said, we need to find, and if we can't find one, we need to build a home for that kind of work. And that's where the New Visions Fellowship came from. But in addition to that, I said, we got to teach these folks how to make it in the business. Because at the end of the day, we are CEOs of our own S-Corps. Mm-hmm. And we are small businesses. And we have to learn not only how to build art, but how to talk about it. And how to draw people who are culturally aligned with or intrigued by it to support and propagate the work. And so our fellowship, the New Visions Fellowship, has a dual purpose. On one side, the fellowship is concerned with fostering the natural born and blessed talent of transgender nonconforming Black playwrights. We meet them where they are and we amplify that brilliance. And on the other side, we provide professional workshops in terms of relationship to collaborators and designers and literary managers and the business at large, so that folks know professionally how to navigate the business of theater, in addition to how to make art, because I think it takes both to have a sustainable practice that's long lasting. You know, we're not going to allow these folks to become the debut darlings and vapid Vanessas that fly that that are here today and gone tomorrow. No, we're writing the new canon, and it's here to stay. And we want to build a house that will stand the test of time, and we have to do so by developing our craft, but also knowing how to survive this business. And so that's what we're doing. And our two fellows are, and Lord, I'm going to get everybody's name, Ayla Sullivan and Nick Mualuko. And if I've mispronounced either of your names, forgive me, darlings, but there are two fellows. And then we have three finalists and another 10 or 12 honorable mentions. And I said to Emmanuel Wilson and to Adamad Cess Rubin, this is a world where everybody wins. Mm-hmm. And so not only do we have programming for the two fellows themselves, but we also have a lot of these workshops. They'll be starting up soon for our larger community, because 43 people who self-identified as Black, trans, gender nonconforming, and playwrights. My goodness, how specific that became. 43 people applied to this fellowship that self-identified within that demographic. Now, anytime any programmer says to you, I don't know any, TGNC, POC playwrights, they ought to email me, because I've got 43 of them and I make a 44th one, you know? So if nothing else, the application process this year was a pronouncement that we are here. I look at all 43 of those applicants and I tip my hat to every single one of them for being brave and innovative and brilliant enough to want to do this and to submit to this program. And I have to tell you, I had the opportunity to interview the folks that would be finalists and honorable mentions. And Michael, I want to tell you, it was the most intriguing and inspiring anthropological study and sociological education I'd ever gotten, because what I learned was my people, trans, gender nonconforming Black writers, have had to create another country. They have developed aesthetics and theories of playmaking and styles of writing that are completely outside of mainstream or dominant cultural dialogue, because they feel that they're not a part of that world and that they don't see themselves in that world. And so they've created another world. And I have to tell you, it's sheerly brilliant. Some of the theories and ideas that these folks have about the reason and occasion for making work in the theater is staggeringly brilliant. Staggeringly brilliant. And it inspired me to be on this tour of interviews.
I'm so inspired by you, and I'm so inspired by the work that you're doing. And it's, to me, what a multi-hyphenate should be. A multi-hyphenate should have a broad perspective of the ways that they can continue to enforce growth and inspire change. And multi-hyphenates lift other artists up. It is a communal effort. While what I said before, on paper, the multi-hyphenate experience looks self-focused because it's about us producing an experience with us relying on our proficiencies, it is really about lifting each other higher. And in turn, we create opportunities for other people. And yes, I am so thankful for the opportunity to speak with you. And I can't wait for more artists to get affected by your efforts and your words. And I'm a huge fan. Consider me a part of your family now, and I will do the same. Where can people find you on social media?
I can be found, I'm most active on Instagram, and my Instagram handle is @RogerQ for Quincy, roger.q.mason@rogerq.mason, and also on Facebook, I'm Roger Q. Mason. And those are the two places where you can find me. And I would be remiss not to say that there are a few opportunities for folks to see some of my work in action right now. I'm not exactly sure when this will be airing, but through August 12th, my play, The Duot, which is a solo show about a wayward FBI informant during the Black Power movement and his spiritual awakening in the Egyptian afterlife. Yes, it's a mouthful, baby.
And that
is starring Greg T. Daniel from HBO's Insecure. That is at Center Theater Group's Digital Stage. And that will be through August 12th. And then I now can say that my film Taffeta, which is based on my play Lavender Men, will be premiering at the Bentonville Film Festival and also at Outfest. So look out for us. I know that both of those will have not only in-person screenings, but also some online screenings for folks.
Congratulations, everyone. Get behind Roger Mason, Roger Q. Mason. They are amazing. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Patrick, for engineering this episode. Thank you, Broadway Podcast Network, Britt, Katie, Dory, Yo. You're all wonderful. Alan, you're all so wonderful. And please follow Dear Multi Hyphenate on Instagram or at the Michael Kushner on Instagram. And also get ready, because How to Be a Multi-Hyphenate in the Theater Business, conversations, advice, and tips from Dear Multi-Hyphenate is coming out in the spring of 2022. So you'll be learning more information about that. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Have a great day. Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.